So we're here with DJ Derek, and he's going to tell us about his most memorable experiences in Bristol from the early years till now. And take your floor, Derek. What's your most memorable things you can remember?
The one that sticks in my mind most of all, I'd already established myself as a DJ within the West Indian community in Bristol from the 70s. But I can't remember the exact date now, but we had, for the first time ever, a black Lord Mayor called Jim Williams, who used to be a union rep for the buses. A lot of the Bristol West Indian guys who I knew in the early days were involved in a thing called the bus boycott, when they wouldn't allow white conductresses to work with black drivers. And this was considered an insult and an outrage, obviously. Anyway, I got to know him over the years, established myself as a DJ in the black pubs and clubs in Bristol, and then was asked to be the DJ at the Jamaican Independence Dance. First white DJ ever to be asked to do that. We had coaches coming down from Birmingham, London, whatever, and the guest of honour was Jim Williams, the first black Lord Mayor. So I was the first white DJ at that event for our first black Lord Mayor. I remember saying, when I introduced him, when he came, please be upstanding for his worshipful Lord Mayor, Jim Williams. So this is quite a first. So this is the question of the reversal of the black dignitary being entertained by the white minstrel. And that show, they had a DJ from Birmingham. It was like an adult sound clash. He would play two records, I would play two records. Mm. And suddenly somebody came up and said, why is it when the white DJ plays, everybody's dancing, and when the black DJ plays, everybody sits down? And I had this poor guy from Birmingham. He didn't know what to put on next. I was trying to lead him with records to keep people on the dance floor, and for some reason he'd start playing some really old scratchy 45s which didn't fit the mood of the thing at all. I think he was playing for himself rather than the crowd. I remember at the end of the night I was handed an envelope with my pay in it, and it said, DJ Derek, the people's champion. And I did that gig for the following 10 years until the younger people weren't so interested in the Jamaican Independence. It started to move to different other venues. But that was one of the gigs that sticks back in my mind. That's where I thought, I've cracked this. Another one, similar, would have been around the same time. There's all, besides the Jamaicans, there's obviously quite a collection of other islands, West Indian islands, particularly Barbados people, Bajans, living in Bath. And they hired the Pavilion in Bath, which is a big venue. And there again, we had coaches coming down from the Midlands, spending the day at Western Supermere. It was on May the 1st, and it was baking hot. It was a heat wave. And they all came back in the evening to the Pavilion. And there was about 100 Bristol West Indian people, West Country West Indian people who knew me. Most of the ones who'd come down from Birmingham in the Midlands didn't know me at all. And it was a question again, why have you got a white DJ? But they were due to have a steel band playing in the middle of the evening, and we got a phone call just after I was starting to get people up and dancing. The phone call said they'd broken down on the motorway and they wouldn't be turning up. And I suddenly realised I was stuck there with 500 people, 400 didn't really know me at all, and I was going to have to entertain them throughout the evening without a break. And being Dominicans, Barbados, Trinidad, they love soca and calypso. So I was playing three or four of those. As I said, it was a boiling hot evening. Everybody was dancing away, and I suddenly realised they were starting to flag a bit. So as they came off, I could see they were going to go off the floor unless I changed the tempo, brought it down. And there was a reggae version of a tune called Gypsy Woman by an artist called Eddie Lovett. which had a very strong introduction. If people knew the record, it's from the first few bars, they'd know what the record was. And as I faded one and brought that in, they all turned back and came on the dance, stayed on the dance floor. And I kept them there. It was a dream, that gig, because I had people coming up and saying, "Ah, DJ, have you got so and so?" And it was the next record I had set up to play. And it gave me, you know, chill bumps down my spine when it first, and it happened about four or five times during the evening. And the evening just flew by. And that's when I thought, that's when, to me, colour didn't make any difference in the end to where I was playing.
Did you find that a regular thing in Bristol, that everyone just accepted you?
Well, because I'd always mixed with the Jamaican community from the 60s, just to hear the music I wanted to hear, not knowing I was going to be a DJ, and buying copies wherever I could, I was just accepted as people. They said, "We don't see you as a white man, we just see you as one of us, one of the community."
What clubs did you mostly used to go to?
The first club I went to in Bristol was the Bamboo, first Jamaican club.
What was that like?
That was legendary, that opened in the mid-60s. And that was because in those days, the generation of people who came over from Jamaica, people of my age or around my age, they weren't welcome into any of the pubs or clubs in Bristol. You had notices up, no Irish, no dogs, and then no blacks. A pub in St. Paul's, a guy I'd already known, a white guy who used to run a restaurant, took over the Criterion in St. Paul's and actually welcomed the mainly Jamaican crowd at that time into the pub. And they bought their own DJ, so I was able to hear this music that I'd been dying to hear. And just became, as I say, part of the furniture. And when Tony Bullimore opened the Bamboo Club, that was brilliant, because I was able to go down there and see all these live acts like Toots and the Maytals, Desmond Decker, all the people who, some of them went on to become nationwide popular because they got in the charts. And then years later, I've met them and supported them as a support DJ in big shows all over the country. And they knew me by that time by reputation, which was wonderful, because the first time I met Toots, I saw him playing in the 60s. He came over to Bristol, having been a support band in Holland for UB40 of all people. Wow. And I went backstage, and Toots was obviously just come off stage, he looked like a boxer, just done 12 rounds, towel around his head, you know, sweating. I waited till he sort of cooled himself down and went and said, "Toots, man, you won't know me, but I remember." He said, "No, man, everybody know you. You're the white man who taught the people talk and play the people music. Shake my hand, man."
Amazing.
And I've played with him a few times since. Other notable gigs, first time I did the Harbourside Festival. That was wonderful. We had...
What year was that?
Oh, now you've got me. When it comes to particular years...
80s,
70s? Oh, no, it was fairly recent. Probably after 2000.
Yeah.
Because it hadn't been going that long. Apart from one year, I did it every year until I retired this last year. That was my last outdoor gig, which got quite a lot of publicity. Time-wise, because I didn't know I was going to be a DJ when I started, I was just working all these little clubs wherever I could just to make a living, not realising I would ultimately be able to make a living out of it. The turning point was in 1994, when BBC Two made a half-hour documentary about me. And that was sparked off by, they had a team from BBC Two in Bristol, and they were looking for ideas to do a series called Picture This, which was so-called normal people doing things you wouldn't expect them to be doing. And I was a white, so-called middle-class guy who was a black DJ, to all intents and purposes. And this guy from Trinidad, he said, would I be interested in taking part? And I was suspicious of the media. I saw what they did when we had the riots in the 80s. their attitude to St. Paul's, and to some extent still is, very negative.
Is that what?
Even if something goes wrong outside of St. Paul's, but it's near St. Paul's, I say it's in St. Paul's. And I said, well, I've built up this relationship in this community. I don't want to have to do a half-hour documentary where I'm look like, to be made to look like a patronising, you know, whatever. And they sent a producer, a girl called Helena Apio, who was half Nigerian and had up to that time been an assistant producer. And I spoke to her for a quarter of an hour. She realised where I was coming from about race relations and all this, being half black herself. And within 10 minutes we agreed, yeah, I'll go ahead and do this.
Mm.
Best thing I ever did. It got major reviews, previews. It was only a half hour documentary, but every national newspaper covered it. The Times made me look a bit of a twit, but I didn't expect that. But after that, WOMAD, World of Music and Dance, they asked me to go and do their backstage bar every year, and then finally put me on a main stage and then sent me all around the world.
Wow, so
they're the only time they've ever done that for a DJ, because by that time I turned what I was doing into an act, if you like. The fascinating thing was the fact by that time I was fluent speaking as a Jamaican DJ. I had to be.
How did you learn how to do that?
I learnt that in a barber shop down by the Inkerman. A man called Bido used to run a barber shop.
Where's that?
St. Nicholas Road, off the back of City Road.
Mm.
And I went in there with a friend of mine, actually, Jamaican from Birmingham, because we were doing sound clashes between Birmingham and London and Bristol at the time. And he said, Derek wants to pick up the lingo. I could understand a certain amount, but when it was spoken very, very fast, it was getting the rhythm of it and the idiosyncrasies within the language itself. Oh, don't mind if he's, no man, he's welcome to sit there. He must keep his eye open and his ear open and his mouth shut till he's ready to say something. And I got it to the end where I could just join in conversations, pick up. Well, of course, the first thing you ever think of is the swear words,
yeah,
particularly in the male barber shop. But then you learn where those phrases were appropriate to use and where they were not. Because you couldn't have a load of people coming into a good nightclub and start using basic street language over the microphone.
Where did you mostly do those types of gigs? In Bristol.
Well, Star and Garter, obviously, is where I started in 1978.
Is that one of your favourites?
I did over 20 years there. That's where I was sort of cut my teeth. Then Turntable Club, having started playing in the Star and Garter, a guy then opened another West Indian club in Bristol called the Turntable, which is opposite where the Knights Templar is now.
Oh.
Well, it used to be an old three-storey warehouse. Used to leak like a sieve.
Wow.
But we had upstairs with what we call big people reggae. You know, middle-aged West Indians, coaches from Birmingham, everybody dressed up in their finest clothes on a Saturday or Friday night. Top artists coming down to play. Nothing to do, no Rasta music, no dancehall music, no slackness, as they said. Certainly no smoking, no dreadlock. It caused a big resentment at the time within the Rasta community in Bristol. But it wasn't just Bristol that were doing that, the clubs in Birmingham were doing the same thing. We wouldn't have minded, I mean, I've got nothing against ganja. I tried it, I didn't like it because it interfered with my beer drinking. But I preferred that to car exhaust fumes.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I did the Turntable Club. There was another club called the Blue Lagoon, which was run by not Jamaicans, one of the other islands, it wasn't Dominica.
Is that where the Blue Lagoon is now? Is it the same place?
No. This was the Blue Lagoon. It was the back of where they built the car park and the galleries, the Cabot Circus. It was down there. It was a big fuss when they pulled it down. it was just a sort of big, almost like a big prefab building on in the corner of what used to be the car park there before they ripped it all down and built like Abbott Circus. But they used to run a domino team, and I used to go down there while they were having their practice sessions and just play music for them. That was great, because they'd asked me to do it. They just loved the atmosphere. I'd play all the oldies that they remembered, all that sort of thing. It's funny how it developed. I was doing this, and obviously while I was doing it, I was automatically getting better at it. I don't know, more in sympathy with, like I say, in sympathy with a crowd of people. And it's not until the last few years I realised, when I started to compare myself with other DJs, why some of them were scared to death to play on the same bill with me. To the extent that even Daddy G, when we shared stages at festivals, he was usually billed, because of the Massive Attack connection, to come on after me. He wouldn't do it in the end. He said, I cannot follow Derek. So he'd go on before me, and as I came on to follow him, he'd bow down to me on stage.
Oh, wow.
Because when the BBC Two made that documentary, they were only about 14, 15 years old, sitting outside, listening to what I was playing, not knowing that they were going to become Massive Attack. And Eddie Hooper, the record producer, was also there. He went to school with them.
Wow.
And after they made the film, I'd never really seen Massive Attack. I'd heard some of their music. I liked Horace Andy, their Jamaican singer, because I'd known him before Massive Attack came along. He was an established reggae singer. But their music didn't mean anything to me. But then they said I was one of their major influences. And with that friendship has just kept going all the time. Every time I see Daddy G, he'll just make a point of, yo, big man, man.
That's great.
Well, it's wonderful how things have happened. It's the past few years I suddenly realised, by people coming up and telling me, especially since I retired, what an impact I've had on people's lives without knowing it. Even the people go, oh, I met my wife when you were getting it. Don't blame that on me.
You have a lot of people coming up to you. I recognise a lot.
Yeah. Well, you know, most of the nights in here, at least one person comes up for a photograph. Sometimes I get totally overwhelmed.
Yeah, well, like Bristol's pioneer of black music.
Well, the other thing, I mean, there were a lot of black DJs around who just tended to stay within that circuit. It was the fact that I did WOMAD that I was then able to play to a far more mixed audience. In those early days, I was lucky to see five white people in a crowd of 100. Very often, I was the only white person in the place. But I was so comfortable with that. And once strangers from outside Bristol realised, yeah, I was just part of the scene, everybody's been comfortable. I've never had, and I could have understood if it had happened, any younger black DJ or black, young black person in general coming along and saying, oh, you've only managed to achieve that because you're white.
Really?
Which could have been. In fact, somebody said they thought that about it.
It's a different file.
Oh, perfect. Okay.
Fine, yeah.
So you can just say whatever you want. What were you talking about?
Yeah, I was saying about the fact that nobody from the black society has ever sort of said I only managed to do what I do because I'm white.
Yeah.
Which could have been a legitimate argument, depending on whether you knew me or didn't know me. But as I say, once people got to know me, they realised that, that's what I loved about it. Everybody said, no, what you've done sounds sincere. We love you because your enthusiasm comes through. You can see that every time you're on stage, you know. And that was the other great thing that happened, was to do a DVD with Dizzy Rascal.
Yeah.
At my age, to be involved with, you know, let's be fair, he's a world famous artist. I wasn't always a great fan of his music. He's a nice kid. Got a great sense of fun. But the kudos among the young generation when I did that, it still happens today when I walk through St. Paul. Louise, that is the DJ on Dizzy Rascal. You're the DJ on Dizzy Rascal.
So you're in the music video in the back DJing.
Yeah.
So random.
It was funny that, because I did a gig in the East End, a club night, and the guy who ultimately made the video for Dizzy Rascal got the idea for doing what he did by seeing me play. I thought this would be great if you could take that guy into a typical environment where you might see an old DJ in a church hall doing a fundraising thing. But to give me that little speaking part on the end where I could start to use a little bit of my voice, it was really funny. And it was the most boring thing I'd ever done in my life. I was there for 12 hours to do a 4.5 minute video.
Oh, no.
And I had to stay there because I was doing the last bit on the microphone. Yeah. I wouldn't do it again. I'm glad I did it, but I wouldn't do it again.
Where did you get all your records and stuff? Were they sourced from Bristol record shops, or did you get them around?
No, most of the early collection that I built up was Black American Rhythm and Blues. Although I used to play in a white rock band back from the 60s, or late 50s, early 60s, I always preferred the black original music to what ultimately ended up as all these groups with three guitars and a singer. Load of them and two a penny, it's still on. And with the black music, it had horn sections, it had keyboards, it sounded as if it was being made by musicians, not three kids who were going to play a few chords on a guitar, and the singer basically shouted into the microphone rather than sang. And that, I just kept, I listened to some white music, some of it was all right, but the best of it was only as good as a mediocre black music, to me. I mean, it's a personal thing. Music is a personal thing. I never bought a Beatles record in my life. I prefer the Rolling Stones even to this day, because their music is basically blues, rhythm and blues. And what happened with the music scene, especially when the Jamaicans started to come to Bristol, is they were listening to the same music that I was trying to get hold of, some successfully through imports and stuff in the early 60s, and other stuff which, once they bought their own records over, Studio One opened in Jamaica, so they started to do their own recording. And in the early days, they were just Jamaican versions of Black American Southern States Rhythm and Blues. But that turned into ska. I was lucky enough to meet the two guys who invented the ska rhythm. It was Lloyd Brevitt, the bass player, and Lloyd Nibb, the drummer. And they formulated this different way of playing black R&B. Mainly, I'm told, because of the lack of in-tune pianos in Jamaica. They loved the boogie beat. If you didn't have in-tune piano, you couldn't do that. So they emphasised the third beat. They said sky on the guitar. Chum, 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 chum. And that, they reworked the bass and drum sound and virtually reversed the beat. You've got to think a totally different way when you're drumming, as if you would if you were playing a straightforward 12-bar, 16-bar blues. And even now, because I never played ska or reggae, I would really have to think before I could sit down behind the kit of drums and actually play it without just slipping back into ordinary rhythm and blues. But that developed into reggae with its own harmonies and styles. Marley then became an international reggae artist. So they're outside of Jamaica once he left. They weren't interested in his music at all. It's amazing, Jamaica, for such a relatively small population, only 2 million, the influence that that beat has had on the world, not just through Marley, but it's, or the early Scatterlite stuff, and then people like Jackie Mitto used to play the organ, or Augustus Pablo on a melodica. Every film, all the adverts, this sort of stuff, so many of them have got this reggae beat. It's so seductive, that lilt. And there's country tunes that have been cut. I don't like country music very much at all. But when you put those nice tunes to a reggae beat, it lifts the whole thing. There was a whole series of LPs that came out, country music in a reggae style. And it takes an average tune and turns it into something that you can dance to. And that's the other thing, really, the fact that I had access to dancing with all these beautiful West Indian girls. And they taught me how to dance reggae properly. To the extent that if I wasn't dancing with a white girl, I could tell immediately whether she danced with an authentic West Indian before. Because if they didn't know, they'd just go... the same with dancing soca or calypso. It's very, very provocative, rude, all done in fern. But people who didn't know, there was some racist idiot who were cute. Funny enough, that was at one of the West Indian Jamaica Independence dances before the one that I did. They accused these black people of making love on the dance floor. They were totally misinterpreting what was actually happening.
The dancing.
Yeah, yeah. It was provocative. It's sexy, there's no doubt about that.
Isn't it called bashman dancing? It's called bashman dancing. That's the type of dance.
Well, well, I don't know what you call that dancing. It's like this twerking business that goes, I love it, man. Yeah, you know me, I got an eye for the young ladies, especially if they got great legs and a good bum. I'm all for that. I know for that.
You know the club that's Cozy's now? That's got Sunday Dub Club and stuff.
Cozy's.
It's in St. Paul's, it's underneath.
Oh yeah, I know Cozy's.
Has that always been Cozy's, or has that always hasn't always been a club, or...?
We're talking about the little one on the corner of Portland Street.
Yeah,
as to my knowledge, it's always been Cozy's. I used to play there. I always found it too small and claustrophobic, particularly in the summer. You were stuck under an arch with a little DJ booth, sweat pouring down, dripping off the ceiling.
It's tiny, isn't it?
And yeah, good friends of mine were running it, and they might still do. I was invited to go down there and play before I retired, but I just couldn't fancy being crammed back in that corner again. They always say don't go back, and generally that's true.
Where's your favourite place to play in Bristol?
Over the years, one of the best periods of time, it probably only lasted about 3 years, there used to be a Jamaican restaurant come nightclub on Stapleton Road, the Sunrise, and that was at the peak at the time, after the Bamboo closed. That was the place where the big people used to meet and dress up and have a good meal. And I had an absolute lovely time playing there. That was when I really felt, that's when they started really to say, they'd recognize me, I might be downtown, or I might be down in another town, and there'd be a coachload of Jamaicans. Oh, look, man, that's our Derek. And I always felt so proud.
Aww.
Our Derek.
Really accepted into the community.
Yeah, totally absorbed in it. I mean, that was wonderful that they wanted me to headline not only the Harborside Festival, but St. Paul's Festival. For the last. And there's something about being on stage and knowing that all those people there, they're your people, if you know what I mean. They're Bristolian people. What, as it ended up, the crowd I had at Queen Square, but he said they'd never seen Queen Square like that before. It was like a football crowd, and it was. I couldn't see the edge of it, and I could recognise individual faces: black, white, young, old. And that's the thing that I've loved. In the end, I seem to have been able to reach out to, well, in clubs, 18 to 80 year olds. Every nationality, and I'm sure it's because the music I play is universal. My taste in music just seems to be very popular to the young and the old. I'm just lucky I managed to make a living out of a hobby. I can't play anything I don't like, but I never bought anything I didn't like. I didn't know I was going to be a DJ. Yeah, I'm practically talked out now.
We can pause it there, everyone. Is there anything else you'd like to add about generally Bristol and the music scene?
Well, funny enough, while it was really developing, I mean, I was aware in the 80s of the early British reggae revolution, the bands from Handsworth in Birmingham and Bristol, Talisman and Black Roots, Black Uhuru, all these different, well, Black Uhuru actually from Jamaica, but they were all part of that 80s reggae sound. I was so involved in playing in different parts of the country, I was never able to realise what was actually happening. So it was massive. I didn't realise what was happening behind the scenes in Bristol. Mm. And it's only in later years that I've realised the part that I actually played in that, unknowing. I was just doing what I loved doing, hoping to make a living out of it. That's the way it worked out in the end.
Paving the way for other people.
As it seems, yeah. I don't think I couldn't have set out to do that. In fact, it was the last thing on earth I wanted to do. I wanted, once I'd broken through the black barrier into a more mixed crowd, I wanted white people to hear the music they were deprived of, because you never heard it on the BBC. After Tony Blackburn broke, John Holt's helped me make it through the night on Radio 1 on air, said it was rubbish and actually broke the record over the microphone. And anybody who ever took any reggae back into BBC after that was shown the door. Tony Blackburn said it's no good. They wouldn't even listen to it. So all that stuff that I was playing to fill in the black dance floors, when I started to play in white pubs and clubs and start, why haven't we heard this music before? Why haven't we heard? I said, ask the BBC why they wouldn't play.
Made it accessible to the white community.
And that's the other reason that the black community music industry loved me, because I was taking their music and giving it other people a chance to listen to it.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, I see it happened. Well, out of a passion, no doubt about it. Have you got any advice for being a DJ? Well, I didn't know I was going to be a DJ, and my only advice would be, don't play anything you don't like, and don't alter your program to play something which is going to clear the dance floor just because somebody wants to hear it before they leave. Tell them, I'm going to play that later when it's appropriate. You either stay, or I'm not losing this dance floor and have to rebuild it. Because the first few times when I made the mistake, I just want to please, I'm going in, mate, can you please play this for me and McGurven, blah, blah. You put a slow tune on when you had a full dance floor. Then they were too embarrassed to dance to it, because then you'd be the only two dancing today. No, that's not going to happen. I'm playing for the people who are staying, not the people who are going. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Derek. Really enjoyed this chat.
Well, it's like, for the past few years, every interview I've ever done, whether it's been for radio, television, newspaper, magazine, they come with a list of questions, they ask me a question, and a quarter of an hour later they say, oh, you've answered every question I had on the piece of paper.
You have, that's brilliant.